This is Midnight in Karachi, and I'm Avish Murad. My guest today is writer Patrick Ness, whose books include the Chaos Walking trilogy, A Monster Calls, The Crane Wife, and more recently, More Than This. He's won 2 Carnegie Medals, the Guardian Children's Fiction Prize, the 2008 Tiptree Award, and the Costa Book Award in 2009. He's also been on the Clark Award shortlist in 2011 for Monsters of Men. Patrick's gorgeous, frightening novel, A Monster Calls, is currently in development as a major motion picture, starring Sigourney Weaver and Liam Neeson. Patrick, welcome to Midnight in Karachi. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I have to start with, no, not Prince and not Kate Bush, because, you know, I'm going to be professional and only get to that later. But a film version of A Monster Calls, I know that's been a big part of your life recently. You've written the screenplay, you've met the cast, you've had a chance to be involved with the film in a way that not all writers whose books are, you know, sold for movies can be. Was writing the screenplay something that you wanted all along, and how's that experience been?
It was, and it's part of a philosophy, really, that even for the very best of reasons, I don't want anybody to be able to tell me what to write. I always want that decision to be mine, which I kind of think is every writer's right, if you see what I mean. I don't want to be limited on any level, because I want to find new ways to tell stories. I want to find new ways that I'm maybe good at telling stories, maybe ways I'm not so good, maybe ways I can learn, you know, because I always want to... I don't know. I never want to be stale. It's the thing that I fear most, really, because it's the thing that I resent most when I read it in a book, when I think that an author has been maybe lazy, right, or mm-hmm. has taken readership for granted. I never, ever want to do that. And so I always want to make myself, I think you should always be slightly scared when you write. I think you should always be slightly nervous that it's, you know, that it could all go terribly wrong, because that's exciting and that keeps you paying attention. And so I never thought that I couldn't write a screenplay. But it was scary. It was something different and something I thought, okay, here's a book that I think I know why it works. I hope I know why it works, if it does. And I think I also might know why and how it could be changed. Sort of the fears you get of Hollywood, that it could be changed so it would work less, if you see what I mean. And I thought, well, okay, if this is going to be a movie, and there's never any guarantee of that at all, but if this is going to be a movie, at least I want to start the conversation. You know, however it goes after that, great. I'm not a filmmaker. It's going to develop. It's going to change. But at least I can start the conversation and say, you know, here's the way I see the story, and here's why I think it works. And it's not the hardest book to adapt in the world. It's, you know, it's the length is quite useful for a screenplay, but it's also difficult. You know, it was just a great challenge. I suppose that's what this all this lengthy windy answer comes down to, is it felt like a good and proper scary challenge.
Were you the only screenwriter on the project?
Yes.
And that must be scarier, of course, because this was, I believe, your first time screenwriting.
Well, you know, I tried things in the past. I sort of call it my first real one. That's not true. I tried in the past, but nothing that ever went anywhere.
Right.
But I don't know. It felt like the right time. It felt like I had learned enough along the way of all the other different writing I've been doing. And it felt like the right time. That sounds awfully whiffy, but I don't know. I can't describe it any more than that. It just felt like... Yeah, give it a try, and it might fail, but you know, I felt pretty good going in. Let's see what happens.
Are they being indulgent with you if you want to do rewrites?
that's a very generous way to ask the question, because it's never me that wants to do the rewrites. It's always them, you know. Because that's I worked on it for about 2.5 years, and a movie is not a book. And that's the main difference. A movie is not a novel. A movie is at best a novella, and usually it's just a long short story, and which has different challenges. It's as hard to make good as a novel is, you know. But there are things that are movie only, and things that are book only, and sort of establishing a context for Connor, giving him a life outside of the story, that kind of stuff. And then, you know, filmmaker comes on, a really good filmmaker. And he's got his ideas, which are, you know, interesting and fascinating. And we sort of work it out and come up with something that works as a movie. It's so different from writing a book. And in a way, that's kind of great, because a book is always mine. And I can put all of my angst and all of my, you know, this is me, this is Patrick Ness, you know, into my books. That was me clenching my fist. You probably couldn't hear that over the radio. And as long as I got that, in a way, I can relax a bit in a screenplay, because all my identity can go into the book. And in a screenplay, I can be more open to the big collaboration, which a screenplay has to be.
Right. Now, did you get to submit a wish list for your ideal cast? I mean, Sigourney Weaver, Liam Neeson, mainly Sigourney Weaver. How cool is that?
Sigourney Weaver is amazing. She's really, really great. And I would not wish list, but you sit down. I lived in Los Angeles for about 10 years through college and after college. And it's funny about LA, you go to a restaurant and you'll meet a waiter who's got Brad Pitt attached to his screenplay. And so I always smile at those conversations of who do we want? And you just sort of have to set aside your shame, I suppose, and just, what the hell, let's go for the big ones. I watched Sigourney film a couple weeks ago, and just, you know, she gets in frame and the cameras start rolling and she's just incredible. And you think, that's really when it feels amazing, when you think, I made up this character and here is somebody that I've seen my whole life acting it out and doing an amazing job. It's mind blowing.
And she's bringing to life something that you've created. And for you to say this means that she must obviously be doing a far better job than anyone else can imagine her to be doing.
Oh, yeah, she's doing great. She's such authority on screen, which is perfect. She's perfect for the grandma. She's perfect.
And are there any other movie deals for your other books that you can talk about?
The Knife and Everything on Letting Go is in development. There's a rewrite going currently on the screenplay, and there is a filmmaker attached to it. I can't say more than that. I wish I could. But I'm not writing that one, so I'm involved in a different way, which is fine by me. It's fine by me because you asked why I wrote A Monster Calls, and I guess I don't really know. I mean, I guess Knife and Everything Go, where I always knew somebody else was going to write it, and that felt kind of correct. And I don't know. So I'm having two completely different experiences, but two equally interesting ones.
Now, speaking of Monster Calls, I have to admit, more so than, you know, the other books of yours that I've read, Monster Calls drove a truck through my heart. Of course, this doesn't mean that your other books are not dark and didn't do that, because they are. You must get asked a great deal as to why they're so dark. Do you have a standard answer by now?
Well, not a standard answer, but if you read, this question often comes up as a criticism. Not you haven't done it, but often it comes up. I mean, the very first time it came up for me was in the Mail, the Daily Mail. I got called a health hazard.
Why would you listen to the Daily Mail?
Oh, I wouldn't. Kind of a badge of honor, really. But it often comes up as a slight criticism, and sometimes it's well intentioned. And I don't want to rain on anyone's. You know, I don't want to question anyone's motives. I don't want to do that. I mean, but my feeling is that. Well, first of all, if you read anything that teenagers write, any of their fiction, it is about 9 million times darker and more harrowing and much more despairing than anything I would ever get away with publishing.
Right.
Because, you know, and I think that's okay. I don't think that's any kind of comment on what that teenagers are. Years of despair, though they clearly are, and you know you can remember the despair when you're a teenager. It's just that's the time when you push boundaries. That's the time when you test out the farthest reaches and step beyond your boundaries, and sometimes make mistakes. And you know, and portraying darkness in fiction, in your own fiction, is a way of pushing that, of pushing at the border, and saying where are my limits? And what happens if I step beyond my limits? And I think that's absolutely fine and perfectly appropriate and should not be changed. And so I think that when I write fiction for teenagers, if I am not addressing what feels dark, because being a teenager does feel very dark for lots of reasons, but if I'm not doing that, then I feel like I'm abandoning them to face it alone. And to me, it was what I've always said to me, that's the immoral choice. I think that's the immoral point of view, to leave them to face it alone. And I think that if I tell the truth about what feels dark And if I take the experience of a teenager seriously, which is all that I ever wanted as a teenager, then when I do tell the truth about what's hopeful and what's possible, and that, yes, your pain is actually real, and yes, it does actually hurt, but it's not the only thing about you, that there is a whole other kind of world that is also true. At the same time, it doesn't negate what's negative, but what's negative also doesn't negate what's positive. So that when I then tell the truth about what could be positive, about friendship and trust and you know, the chance for something better, I'm more believed because I haven't lied about what is difficult. And so, and honestly, when I start a book, I never think of it in those terms. I genuinely don't. I feel like, you know, I want to tell what feels the most true. And being a teenager is hard. And I respect that.
You know, you're talking about friendship and you're talking about trust. And it's interesting because A Monster Calls started off in someone else's hands. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to have that, well, I wouldn't want to call it a burden, but was there a great sense of responsibility in creating that story and then finishing it?
This sounds like a terrible answer, but no, and no for not the reason you might think. It's not some raging egomaniacal reason that it's got to be mine. But my worry, and one of the reasons I hesitated before I took it on, was a story has to be a story first. Absolutely first. It can't be anything else. Otherwise, nobody wants to read it. It can't be a sermon. It can't be a lesson. It can't, even for, as I said, the very best of reasons, it can't be a tribute. Sean Dowd is an amazing writer. Her books are fantastic. But if I try to recreate a Siobhan Dowd book, then that is me recreating a Siobhan Dowd book before I'm telling a story. And most importantly, that's not what she would have done. You know, she would have told a story first. And so if that burden had been too heavy, I wouldn't have done it, because I would have thought it would have gotten away in the way of telling a story. And what I was most afraid of, the worst possible outcome is you write a bad book. And, you know, because she wouldn't have written a bad book. She would have written a terrific one. And so I kind of thought that my biggest responsibility, to use the word, was to set that aside and just to do what she would have done, which is let the story grow and change and become itself. And in doing that, that's the way that you pay the best tribute, because that was her best strength. And so, you know, I described in the introduction that it felt like a game, like taking a baton and running with it. And that's true. That's true. So I didn't feel like I needed to write a tribute, because she wouldn't have written a tribute. And the best tribute is to just tell the best story. And that's, I don't know, that's what I wanted. And so when I got to the place in my head where I could feel free, then I thought, oh, that's when I knew I could do it. And I'll tell you when that was, actually. That was a specific moment when that happened, because I was, you know, reading her materials, and she had an opening, and she had a structural idea that the monster would tell stories. And she had a couple of the characters, and so I had to invent a few more. But I was thinking about the material, and I had the idea of Connor coming out of what was then a dream to find that he destroyed his grandmother's sitting room. And I thought, oh, that's the whole book. That's the fulcrum of the book. That's what the whole book is about. All of this rage that he's holding down, that he's so afraid of. Here's the moment where he expresses it in the worst possible way. I thought, that's the whole book. And that's when I knew, this is a story first. This is a powerful thing that she's come up with, and this is hopefully a powerful thing that I can run along with. And that's when I knew I could do it. Not as much as I admired her, I wouldn't want to write. Do you see what I mean? Is this making any sense? The best tribute is not writing a tribute, if you see what I mean. And I knew that there was a powerful story there when I responded to her material like that, and I thought, okay. Together, maybe we can make something. Maybe make something special. Maybe.
I think you did all right. For what it's worth.
I hope so. I'm really proud of it. It feels like a once in a lifetime thing.
Yeah, I think as well you should be. Now, growing up is hard, being a teenager is hard. Writing for teenagers is probably hard too, but you've written both, obviously, young adult fiction and for adults as well. I'm not going to ask if one comes easier than the other, because I think all writing is in its own way pretty hard, let's face it. But does one come more naturally than the other?
No. I wish one did, and then I would do that one more often. But no, I mean, I really don't treat them any differently at all. The process is 100% the same. I put the same investment into both. I put the same physical effort into both. They both take about the same amount of time. So, and I'm glad of that, because I hope it keeps the material honest. That's, you know, I'd be afraid that if one came easy, I'm always afraid that if it comes really easy, then I don't know, then I'm missing something. But it's I just get an idea and I play around with it and I let it grow and I let other ideas stick to it and get attracted to it. And then it kind of tells me whether it's for adults or for teenagers. And I think I've said this all the time, and I say this to teenagers when I talk to them, is that the most important thing about writing and about reading is to not be a snob. And if the material says it needs to be for teenagers, fantastic. There is no artistic limitation there. That is not somehow lesser than writing an adult novel. And if it says the material says it's for an adult, for adults, then great, that's fine too. So I think that to me is the important thing in the process, is to not, I don't know, not sort of have certainly any qualitative differentiation between the two, because I really don't believe it that there is, but also just to say, great, there is writing anything good is so hard that if you give yourself, if you let yourself off the hook by saying, oh, it's just for kids, then you're in for a loser, I think. And I don't know, it should always be hard. It should always be a challenge. And I don't really see a difference between the two. I genuinely don't. That sounds disingenuous. It sounds sort of, you know, the right on thing to say, but I genuinely believe that.
No, it's absolutely a legitimate point. And because a lot of teens, of course, connect with your work, do you find, as you were mentioning earlier, that you sort of feel a sense of responsibility to be honest in your writing for teenagers or young adults? Do you find them asking, when they do sort of see you, or whether you go to their schools or whatever it is, do you find them asking you for advice? I mean, that's quite a responsibility, giving advice to teenagers, you know? We've all been there. You know, it's a scary thing to be a teenager.
Yeah, but do you mean advice in their lives?
Well, do they? What's the most interesting question, for example, that they've ever asked you, that someone has ever asked you?
It won't be the one you expect. I had one boy ask, have you ever suffered a serious injury?
Wow.
And I said, have you ever suffered a serious injury? And he nodded. I think he just wanted to talk about it, and that's fine. But for advice, gosh, in their lives, no. They usually don't. And they ask a lot about writing and writing advice. But I don't know, hopefully, I don't know, I don't want to be an advice giver. Because what do I know, you know? Do you know what I mean? Why? Yeah. What arrogance to say that I somehow have some right path. I think all I can share, and, you know, and what I try to talk about in the books is a truthful experience, I hope. And, you know, some of it is based on my own experience. Some of it is things I thought about when I was a teenager. And so all you can really say is, not what you should do, but this is what I did. And it turned out this way. And that to me is personally the advice that I trust the most. And I suppose that's kind of what I try to put in my books. You know, this is a specific experience of a character. And these are decisions they made. And this is how those decisions turned out. And I don't know, I kind of think that's the only legitimate quote-unquote advice you can give. Because otherwise anything is a theoretical. And everyone's an individual, and you've got to make your own decisions, I suppose.
Yeah.
They tend not to, but it's mostly advice about writing they want.
Well, even as a teenager, I think part of growing up is making perhaps wrong decisions as well, and learning from them, of course. Now, what I'm really interested in knowing is, were you writing when you were a teenager? And if you were, what kind of stuff was it?
When I look back, I was writing even before. I remember writing sort of 9, 10 years old. You know, when you're that young, it's usually mimicry. It's usually copying things that you've read, but I think that's okay. I think that's how you figure out what voice sounds like. And I think that's, I don't know, you figure out how to lay out a story and how characters work and so on. And when I was a teenager, my stuff was just as dark as any of the stuff that I read by teenagers today. I mean, it was just all about alienation. And there's a lot about the end of the world because it was the 80s. So we were all under a particular nuclear threat, or so we thought. So there's lots about fallout and lots about, you know, bunkers and things like that. But again, I think that's okay. I think that's absolutely fine. It's tapping into your current emotional truth. And isn't that what all writing is supposed to be? I think so.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, my next question was something that I wrote down, and then I went and I was still, you know, looking things up about you, and I saw a little video where you admitted what I'm basically going to say is that everyone's okay. got a favorite child, whether they admit it openly or not. And you said the same thing online, and I was very glad because I said, okay, now he can't really, you know, deny it. And my mom actually told me this years ago, that no matter what a parent tells their child, there is always one favorite child if there's more than one. So I think that was a very honest moment for her to tell me this, because I have two siblings. Mm-hmm. But everyone's got a famous child, as I said, as you admitted. Which one's yours from all your books?
That's the thing. Everybody does have a favorite child, but they're never going to tell you. Because wouldn't that hideously alienate all the other children?
I won't tell the books if you won't.
Stop. Favorite. They're all this. I mean, again, it sounds like I'm dodging the question, but I love them all for different reasons. And I think that's also permitted. I think that's also okay. I mean, A Monster Calls feels like something that, you know, will never happen again. And it shouldn't ever happen again. It came up under tragic circumstances. It was a totally unexpected opportunity. And it kind of felt like me and Siobhan kind of got to something in that. And I'm really proud of that. And I'm really, I feel like it kind of got to what I wanted it to get to in that book. But then you got something like The Knife for Never Letting Go, which was a unique writing experience because it felt like a rocket. It felt like it came down so fast on the page that I've never had an experience like that. And that kind of energy, God, I wish I could do that over and over and over again. And I don't know how to replicate that. It just came and it didn't. And then I like More Than This because it's probably my most personal book. So I suppose different ones for different reasons. I don't know. I kind of think maybe my best book is The Ask and the Answer. But it's sort of like the least loved, it's kind of like Empire Strikes Back. There you go. It's the one everybody knows is the best, but nobody loves it.
So basically my assessment from this answer is that you could really be a good parent.
Ooh, or just a wishy-washy one. You're all special to me, all of you.
All of you, that's right. Now, you travel a great deal for book-related stuff. I know even when we were coordinating this, you said you were, you know, back and forth between places. Is that an important part of being a writer? The movements, the going out and representing your books, the talking to your readers part?
Well, I mean, I'm really lucky, first of all, that I get to do it. That I get asked. I mean, I'm really lucky. I'm knocking wood as we speak. I think so. I mean, I love it. I love meeting readers. I just love it. I love it because the kind of kids who come to book events, they've chosen you, and Jesus, what a hell of a thing that is. That's amazing. That's amazing that somebody has picked up my book and, you know, then wanted to come see me about it. And that's, gosh, I mean, I'm so lucky about that. And I get a lot of gay kids who just want to say hey, and just want to say hello, and just want to say that they liked seeing themselves in a book. That's really important to me as well. And so stuff like that, that's incredible. And it feels, I'm feeling all gushy. I just before this interview, I just did a 10K run. And so I think I'm flooded with sort of post-run endorphins. So I think I'm feeling particularly loved up at the minute, but it is, God, it's amazing. And it's also just to connect with the reader. And it kind of happens on Twitter as well. And social networking. Like every once in a while, there's a reader in Kazakhstan who will send me a tweet, and she doesn't want a conversation. She just wants to say, I read this book and I loved it. And how amazing is that? So to travel and to meet people like that, and I've been to, gosh, where have I been? I've been to Hungary and Slovenia and Taiwan. Gosh, and I was just in America, not doing book stuff, but for other writing meetings. But yeah, I love it. I do love it. It's tiring. I'm quite jet lagged at the minute because I just got back from Los Angeles. But yeah, boy, what a terrible waffly answer that was.
No, very impressive that you took your jet lag for a 10K run.
Really? It wasn't an easy 10K run.
Oh. Well, it never is, but I mean, that's still really impressive. I would have slept a week.
I got things to do. Yeah.
Let's talk about the fact that a lot of kids come up to you and relate to you as a result of you being open about the fact that you're gay. And how does that work out for you as a writer? I mean, have you ever had people... And it's strange because I read your tweets and I read about some of the reactions that you get and some of the things that, you know, that you face when you're out there and you're reading and people are sometimes surprised or readers are sometimes surprised. Is there ever a strange interaction when, you know, for example, somebody who's been reading your book doesn't realize it, does realize it? Does that ever change anything for them? Should it? Does it at all ever? And does that change anything for you as a writer?
Well, one of the real perks of writing for teenagers is... it doesn't really bother teenagers almost at all. I mean, really, really at all. Anybody sort of under the age of 25 does not care. And how wonderful that is, how fantastic that is. And I love that. But having said that, it's still quite difficult. And it's still quite difficult for the teenager who's afraid to say, and the teenager who's in the closet or maybe doesn't have a support around them, and that's also very common, particularly in America, but that's not true. It happens everywhere, and so it's important to me. I always say there are a couple ways that you can change the world, and one of the ways to change the world is to pretend that the world has already changed, and so that's the kind of approach I like to do in the books. Is I like to pretend that this isn't a big deal, and that is sometimes really, really powerful for a kid who's struggling. That's for just someone to say, second, yeah, well, even like more than this, he struggles with it, and he doesn't struggle with being gay. He struggles because of a loss of love, and that's universal. You know, everybody right. feels that. Everybody knows that. And I haven't had not one single teenager have a problem with that. I've had older people have a problem with that. You know, I've gotten a few one star reviews, didn't know this was a gay book type thing, but overwhelmingly teenagers want to talk about the loss of love, you know, that feeling that someone you loved maybe doesn't love you back as much as you thought. And that's such a painful feeling. That's such a universal feeling. But also then for a gay kid who reads it, wow, how nice to just for once see your experience validated as truthful and powerful and universal. Again, that sounds really pompous. I don't mean it in a pompous way. I just mean, it's that whole thing about, you know, needing diverse books. You need the simple need to see yourself in a story, the simple need to see that you have just as much right to be in a story as anybody else, and that you don't need special permission to be in a story, and that your story matters just as much as everybody else's story matters, and it's just as powerful and just as relatable too, it shouldn't be something we have to argue about. It shouldn't be something we have to make a point of, but of course we do. And so I write from my experience. I respond to stories from my experience. And I'm, if I didn't put in something like Seth and More Than This or Todd's parents in the Chaos Walking trilogy, Ben and Killian, I'd be ignoring part of myself, and I'd be ignoring part of a story that I want to tell. And again, it's what's a bit what I said earlier. I mean, you can't write a sermon as righteous and proper as a sermon might be. Nobody wants to read a sermon. You have to write a story, and so it becomes a question of how do you. It's the philosophy of teach them when they don't know they're learning. Right. And I suppose that's what it is. I don't want it to be a sermon. I want it to be a really, really good story. But why the hell shouldn't a really good story involve anyone at all? Involve anyone who, you know, involve anyone's experience, however out of the mainstream it might be. Why shouldn't they be allowed to be involved in a really good story? And I suppose that's my point of view. And how, I don't know, gosh, it's what I wanted to read. That's what it all really comes down to. It's what I wanted to read when I was 15, and there was nothing to read, and that's important to me.
And it's strange that you say, why shouldn't someone who's not in the mainstream not be included? I find that always an odd thing when people are talking about diversity in books, whether it is, you know, of gender or sexuality or racial diversity, of whatever kind of diversity. I always find that weird because the things that we are talking about as diverse are actually not really off or outside of the mainstream anymore.
I know.
You know?
Yeah.
I know what you mean. Yeah, yeah, in terms of, for example, as you're saying, you're talking about, you know, I mean, really, homosexuality is not the mainstream. It is. This is just life. It's just one aspect of life. Just in the same way that when you talk about racial diversity, and this is something obviously that I look for, or I look to and think about, you know, there are probably really more brown, I mean, there are more brown people out there. So, I mean, how are you saying that it's not, it's just, it's a weird thing to say that, oh, we must include people outside of, it just makes you question what mainstream means.
Yeah. It's something that I talk to students about, and it's that if you are purporting to reflect the world in your writing, then diversity should come naturally.
Right.
Because as exactly as you said, I mean, you know, my own family, my own immediate family contains a bunch of racial diversity. And if I'm just writing stories about white kids, then I'm consciously leaving out my family.
Right.
And, you know, and that's, I take your point exactly. I think that's exactly right. To not reflect diversity is to just, it's not to, I don't want to be overly, I don't want to be pious here because I don't like piety either, but to not do it is to ignore the world. And then how can you say that you're telling the truth, you know, if you're not reporting the world as you see it?
Yeah. Plus, it's boring. I mean, let's be honest, if you're just talking about the same thing continuously, right? No matter what it is, it can be really boring.
Well, there are lots of ways to be boring, and that is definitely one of them. But yeah. Yeah, and also it's just, again, it's, you know, I want my niece to see herself in a book, for Christ's sake. And why should that be so hard?
Yeah.
You know, why should that be difficult? Why should she have to search and search and search for a book when she doesn't have to search in the world to find friends?
Absolutely.
So, I take your point. Exactly.
Now, I know that you have theme songs for each of your books, which, of course, makes perfect sense. What I can't understand is, why has there been no Prince yet, Patrick? What is up with this? What's going on?
I don't know why it's a theme song, but it's more, the song is like an emotional touchstone, and I don't know why one is and one isn't. I mean, music is inexplicable. Why somebody likes something, why somebody doesn't, is inexplicable. And so for each book, I tend to have a song that I'm not writing about the song. I'm not trying to recreate the song, but it's, the song makes me feel a way that I want a reader to feel, or that I want the reader to feel when they read the book. So it's just sort of, it's kind of an emotional reminder. And so for A Monster Calls, it was Mercy Street, the Peter Gabriel song. For Knife of Never Letting Go, it was a song by Muse with the ridiculous name of Map of the Problematique, but it's a great running song. And More Than This is actually after the Peter Gabriel song More Than This. So I don't know. I don't know why something applies to a story. I keep my mind open. I don't know what's going to happen next. So I don't know. I do like Prince.
You do like Prince. As do I. So, you know, work on that, please.
But you never know where inspiration is going to come from. No idea. No idea at all. So I'm open to the possibility.
I don't think it's going to come from his new stuff somehow.
God, you know, the thing is, I remember being a teenager and hearing Kiss for the first time. And Kiss has some antecedents. You know, there are some funk antecedents and there are some 70s influences. But, you know, when you're a teenage kid living in a really suburban town in America, Kiss sounds like it's from an alien.
Right.
You know, it sounds like it just came down from space, and it's such a magnificent song, and it's everything creative that I want my own creativity to be, if you see what I mean. It's existing on its own terms. It's not pandering to you. It's not easy on the ear the first time. You know, you think, whoa, what's this? You've got to get used to it. But then it is just the most amazing song. It's confident that you're going to love it. And that's without being obnoxious about it. It just says, here's my song on my terms, in my vocabulary, in my language. Come along with me. And that's kind of everything that I would love to be able to do in every story, is that kind of come with me. Let's find something new. And so, yeah, Kiss in particular is just an amazing song to me, an amazing touchstone for me.
So basically, Kiss is the theme song for everything you've ever written.
Sure, we can call it that way. It's my uber overarching theme song. It's a great song.
I believe you have a new book coming out in 2015. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, it's called The Rest of Us Just Live Here. It's the basic idea is, what if you lived in a world that was a lot like a YA novel, but you weren't the chosen one? You know, you weren't Katniss, and you weren't what's her name in Twilight. What is her name?
Bella Swan,
because I was remembering Edward and the other one. What if you weren't that kid? You know, what if you just wanted to go to high school and go to the prom and ask somebody out on a date before the chosen ones blew up the high school again? And I thought that was kind of funny, and I thought I really liked that idea. And it's kind of about that, and it's it's a different kind of thing. I hope it's kind of moving. But that's what it's about. What if you weren't the chosen one and were just some guy, you know, trying to live your own life? Because you know the appeal of somebody like Bella or Katniss, although they're radically different characters, obviously. And we could talk for a long time about Bella,
right,
and how problematic she might be. the appeal of that is that, I always say that the working principle of every teenager is to feel different. Even if you're popular, you always feel like you're the only one in the world and you are completely different from everybody else. And that's as it should be. And that's natural, I think, because it's the first time in your life you're saying, I am not this. I am this thing instead. And that's the important bit of growing up. It's a violent thing. It's a violent thing to your personality to realize that you're not just this kid who's a part of your family, that you're your own person. And books like Hunger Games, books like Harry Potter is the best example, is that it gives you a reason for feeling different. You know, you are feel different because you're the chosen one. And it's no wonder teenagers and most people respond to those narratives. But I thought, have we gotten to the point where, since pretty much every teenage book is about the chosen one, are we actually leaving people out? Are we leaving out those kids who think, I'm not even the chosen one? Has the chosen one become the common state of affairs? And I thought, well, what if you're just a normal kid? What if you're a couple of normal kids? It's about a boy and his sister and the girl that he is secretly in love with and his best friend. And they all just feel like normal kids and they just want to get through high school while trying to survive this horrible thing that's going on that the chosen ones are fighting. And so that's what it was. Trying to find, as they're saying on the blurb, you know, trying to find something extraordinary in your ordinary life, because I don't know, not to get all too, again, this is post-run endorphins, but not to get all gushy, but it's, life is kind of amazing. That we even exist is kind of amazing, in that we are able to have friends and have friends that we love and survive in a world that's difficult and, you know, existential is kind of amazing. And so it's the book, I hope, is a bit about that. It's about, you know, that there is a lot of amazing stuff just right under your nose, and it doesn't have to be you fighting the evil whatever. It can be falling in love with the right person or falling in love with your friend and just, you know, realizing that how much you love your friend. So that's kind of what it's about.
I have to say, that sounds fascinating. When you're talking about, say, you know, the kids who aren't the chosen ones, in my head I'm seeing all those other kids who went to high school with Buffy and the Scoobies while they went around saving the world again and again.
Exactly.
And literally blowing up the high school. You know, it was on a hellmouth, yeah. Fine. But there were lots of kids in that high school.
Yeah.
And
yeah, yeah.
Every
what was it
so
like for them?
Yeah. Every so often we sort of, you know, we met them, but then the times that we did meet them, they ended up being those kind of, you know, something weird was happening with them and they were in their own way.
Their red shirts. Yeah, they
right,
were dying.
Right, exactly. And I love this idea because I love the idea of peripheral characters or characters who have been peripheral to a story or a narrative for a very long time coming to life or being brought into light.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
It's like a Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead.
Exactly. That's exactly what I was going to say. Yeah.
So that sounds fascinating. So hurry up.
It's done. It's just coming up.
Fantastic. I believe you work with the 1,000 words a day formula.
Pretty much, yeah. I tend to do about 1,500 now, but, you know, I work up to that. But that works for me. You know, if it doesn't work for any young aspiring writers out there, that's fine. Find something that works for you. But that's how I do it. Because to me, working to a goal is better than working to time. Some people might work better to time. They might say, I'm going to work for 2 hours and that's better for them. But a goal is better for me.
And so the book is done and you are now just waiting for it to happen. So we just have to hold on. 2015 is almost here.
It is, yeah. Not too long to wait. I got other things to write, I suppose. So.
Well, I'm very excited about that, Patrick. Thank you so much for talking to us today.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Under the Radar on Midnight in Karachi. I've written about today's featured story on the Under the Radar column for Dora.com before, but it's worth bringing up here as well. Rukaiya Hussain's Sultana's Dream is an early feminist classic, a story I was amazed to read much later in life, and I'm still shocked it isn't taught in every classroom in the subcontinent. Written in English in 1905 by a Bangladeshi woman called Rukaiya Hussain, who went on to be a tireless crusader for the education of young girls in the Indian subcontinent. The story is about a young woman who walks with another woman she assumes to be her friend to a strange new world called Ladyland, a world where women run everything and the men have retired into parda, retired, as it were, from the running of the world. With them out of the way, the women are able to get a lot more done, whether it's manage politics, end wars, beautify their country, or create art. Sultana's Dream is clever, it's Swiftian, and it's amazing not just for its early feminist science fictional premise, but also because Hussain makes these really astute, sly comments about colonialism. She knew what was up. The story is right up there with any of the Western feminist science fiction stories you can think of. Do look it up. It's online for you to read in its entirety. Sultana's Dream by Rukaiya Hussain on today's Under the Radar. Midnight in Karachi with Mavish Murad on Tor.com.